Hi, this is Julie Newmar, and you're watching Mr. Media.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to singer Paul Cowsill. Yep, you heard me right. My guest is a member of the 1960s family singing sensation, the Cowsills. They inspired a TV show you might have heard of, The Partridge Family. Stick around. We're going to get to the bottom of what exactly a Cowsill is right after this musical interlude. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview. The show is brought to you today by Amazon.com, the world's greatest store for everything from books and movies to computers, TVs, and even my favorite soft drink, Pepsi Wild Cherry. Thinking about buying something online from Amazon or just want to do a little window shopping? You can save yourself a lot of money and help support Mr. Media, that's me, by clicking on one of the Amazon ads at MrMedia.com and start your shopping with us. Get yourself the new iPad or Kindle Fire. Feeling a little racy today? Amazon's got what you need to feel exciting and new, as they used to sing on The Love Boat. Remember, start your next shopping trip from the comfort of your own home, car, hotel, or office with Amazon.com at MrMedia.com. That's right, MrMedia.com. And folks, thanks for your support. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of adult men who have all sorts of despicable ways to take advantage of talented teenagers in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida.
Give me a head with hair. Long, beautiful hair, shining, gleaming, streaming, flaxing, waxing. Give me down to there, hair. Shoulder length longer. Hair. Here, baby, there, mama, everywhere, daddy, daddy, hair. Hair. Grow it, show it, long as I can grow it, my hair.
One of the most musically gifted American families to hit the top of the pop charts, the Cowsills rose to fame, success, and stardom in the late 60s. 5 years later, their star came crashing back down to earth.
It was a week or so before Christmas, 1968, and I owned fewer than five long-playing record albums, including The Monkees' Headquarters and the first two Beatles albums. I played them endlessly on what was essentially a toy record player. That its sound was tinny and that it didn't get very loud really didn't matter to me. I had my very own music. And I well remember that holiday season, visiting my friend's parents, Mickey and Ginny, and their infant son, Mickey Jr. Now, Mickey Sr. was a New Brunswick, New Jersey cop, and the family lived in a modest apartment in a small complex overlooking the Raritan River. The visit was largely uninteresting for me, except when Ginny handed me a wrapped present from under the family Christmas tree. It was a new record. Now, what else could be that shape, right? So 8-year-old me quickly tore off the wrapping and discovered The Rain, The Park, and Other Things, the best of the Cowsills inside. Now, I didn't know anything about the Cowsills at the time, but it had a funny caricature of the family on the cover, and I couldn't wait to get home and put it on my cheap turntable to hear it. Instead of, however, being appreciative of the gift, I became a bit of a brat because I couldn't wait to get out of there and listen to it. Songs such as Hair and We Can Fly and Indian Lake became lifetime favorites that I have yet to tire of hearing. And like a lot of bands from that era, the Cowsills, unfortunately, soon disappeared from view. 1910 Fruit Gum Company, anybody? And I honestly didn't give them a whole lot of thought until last week when I was invited to watch a new documentary, Family Band, The Cowsills Story, which is about the real family behind the singing family. Now, the film is airing this month on Showtime, and whether you're old enough to remember the Cowsills, or even the TV sitcom they inspired later, The Partridge Family, this heart-wrenching tale is a must-see, from family squabbles and singing with mom to a mentally and physically abusive dad and massive lost revenues to latter-day triumphs and tribulations. Joining me today to talk about his family, the band, the documentary, and the TV show Grimm, and we'll explain that shortly, is Paul Kalsil. Paul, welcome to Mr. Media.
Hi, Bob. How's you doing?
Doing okay.
Good.
Really excited to have you here, and found out it just as we were talking when I asked you about the shirt. And we might as well explain this now because people are going to wonder otherwise. Why do you have a Grimm season two shirt on, Paul?
I work for Grimm. That is my day job, as it were. Never quit your day job in rock and roll, Bob. I work on Grimm, and I have for both seasons. It's a great show to have in Portland, and I'm a landscaper. I call myself an extreme landscaper, and the guys that do the landscaping bring all big trees in, and they want to shoot where there's no forest, but they want the forest to come in to the shot, and so we have to bring the forest in, and it's a fun job. I did it for Twilight as well, but Grimm is the best.
Oh, now see, stuff keeps pouring out of you every time you say something. You did it for Twilight as well?
Yeah, I was the on-set Greensman second unit for the first Twilight movie.
I'll be damned. And tell us the other credit that you recently came off of.
Oh, well, Leverage. I worked on Leverage as well. And then I went to Grimm a few years ago when that came to town. Because they don't have much greens on Leverage. I actually was a scenic painter on Leverage. But I like to be outside with the greens and stuff. So.
Good to be multi-talented.
Well, yeah, that's what I have found in life. At first I thought, my God, I'm never going to get that gold watch from any company because I just don't stay focused that long. But now as my life is down this end, it's been great to have all these gigs that I've done.
And I mean, you know, when you're working on set and you're, you know, lost in your work and you're, you know, setting up, do people ever point out that they hear you, you know, humming, you know, give me it down to there, you know, shoulder length or longer?
Yeah, all the time. I'm singing all the time. What happens to me is somebody will say something and then I'll remember a song from the 50s or 60s or 70s that has that word in it. And then I'll start singing a song. I drive my friends pretty crazy with that.
And tilt your head just a little bit so everyone can see that you still have plenty of that hair.
I have plenty of hair, but let's tilt down a little bit. Let's be honest here with your peeps, Bob. But
I will.
I have this thing going on right here.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks I'm combing hair over. I'm really not. I'm just like, this piece right here is called the Kalsil front piece. And we're going to have that forever. And I'm going to hold on for that front piece forever.
Sounds like instead of the Kalsil, it should have been the Cowlicks.
Yeah. Well, you know, it makes hair really interesting when we do it in our shows now, because during that whole long piece that they actually played on the radio, you know, she asked me why, you know, we'll go on and, you know, we'll talk. And one of my lines I know in the show is the only place I see hair growing is out of my ears and my nose. Well, I can't get it to stop there. Crazy.
Age is a funny thing, isn't it?
It is.
So, you know, I watched the film. And I mean, I barely know where to start. Fortunately, we had Grimm to work from, so we've established kind of what you're doing now, and we'll talk about the current status of the band maybe a little later.
Sure.
But so it's interesting, as we were setting up this interview, there was a little discussion about where we were in 68. You know what I was doing in 68? I was an 8-year-old boy. I got the best of the Kalsils for a Christmas present. Tell me, because I think you remember, tell me about 1968 and being a member of the Kalsils Christmas.
Okay, for me, it was the greatest time. You know, I was the last guy in this band, and it took some effort to get into this band. You know, Dad was picking people. If we did come in, it was first started with Bill and Bob, and, you know, Bill latched on to Barry playing bass guitar and some drums, you know, but that was just three, and so Dad was looking for a fourth, and I remember he put us all on the couch, and he goes, I need one more person to play. I need a drummer, and so, gosh, we're all just, nobody knew if we could drum or not. We were just all going, yeah, make us that guy. Everybody trying to sit tall, and John was picked, you know. And John Duquesne, and he's a great drummer. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, you lost your moments. And as that kept going on, and so that was like 1966. Mm-hmm. And then 1967, and there was a big there was a lot happening in 66 for the guys, for the four boys. They were playing a thing called Sound Blast 66, and the Beach Boys were, it was at Yankee Stadium, the Beach Boys, Little Stevie Wonder, the McCoys, and the Cowsills were all on that bill. And we didn't have a record company at the time. It might have been with Mercury Records, with Johnny Nash's label. But nothing was happening musically speaking as to what was going to happen in just a year. Mm-hmm. So 66 came, 67 came, and boy, Rain the Park happened in 1967. And that was still, it all crisscrossed so quickly with us. That was 67. Rain the Park comes out. My mom is put in the band and she records some backgrounds on that record, but really it was just Bob and Barry and John and Bill. There was no Susan even at this time. Mm. Then a few months went by. Susan was put on. We do the Ed Sullivan show. And right after Ed Sullivan show, I'm put in the band. But it all happened in 67. I was 16. Mm. And so now we're hearing all of this. You know, we're traveling the country. Oh, excuse me. Here. We're traveling all over the country on a bus. Mm-hmm. And the Partridge Family was about our family. And the first episode, you know, and they all came to live with us, Bob. It was so funny. Michael Eisenberg was one of the kids that came to live with us to see if this Partridge Family kind of Shirley Jones thing was going to work out between the Cowsills and Shirley Jones. It was always a vehicle for Shirley Jones. Mm. And it was, our mom was never a part of the thought process to the Partridge Family. And us kids were going to be the kids and Shirley was going to be the mom. And that was really a deal breaker there for Dad. Hmm. You know, we had our own mom and they wanted Shirley and that's the way that was going to roll. And so they thought we were the boys anyway, not Susan. They thought she would work very well in the show, but the boys were really kind of rough around the edges. They weren't actors is what Shirley told us, you know? And so my dad had the meeting and I remember we were all at Screen Gems and he just said, hey, go find some good actors and make a good show. And that was it. And that was our connection with the Partridge Family.
Wow.
And then the first episode, they were on the bus and it seemed kind of normal. It could have been us, but there were a few details missing in our eyes. And then it just became the TV show. Without the Partridge Family, excuse me, Bob, but without that Partridge Family show, me and you, I don't feel would be sitting here talking today.
Really?
Yeah, because we were there. And like you say, everybody in our time and in our generation and we all had our hits. We had our movement to the top and then the slide down. I mean, we can grab the whole list of people. I don't care if they were one hit wonders or if they had six or five hits. It all came and went in this kind of this band of how it went, you know, and it's and so I've lost my train of thought.
Well, you're just saying that there's kind of this big arc that everyone went through.
Right. And so what happened was, so then we were fading. And as we were fading soon to be in anonymity, the Partridge Family is now grabbing hold and every kid in America is loving the Partridge Family. So all those years that we were here, the Partridge Family was thriving and growing and inevitably that show could not carry on without carrying our name with it, being that we were the true family inspiration behind this TV show. And so that kept us in people's eyes for a long time. You know, we were really young. Dick Clark comes to us and said, you know, after Hair, which was our last hit, Dick Clark comes to us and goes, hey, come on out on the road with us. You'll do, you know, Rain the Park. You'll do Indian Lake and Hair, you know, and you'll make a lot of money. Come on out. I've got these tours going all over the United States. And we were actually in Dick's office with him. And Dick was going, okay, let's do this. And so Dick goes, well, where's the contract? Let's get these guys signed up on this contract. And there was no contract at this office. Okay. So the girl goes, well, let's let Dick get back to work. Just wanted to say hi to us anyway. And hey, glad to have you aboard. We go out into this gal's office and she doesn't have the contract. And she goes, hey, could you guys come back in 2 hours? So we go to lunch, Bob, John, me and Susan. We go to lunch and we're talking about, okay, now if we do this, you know, we're not going to be doing any more albums. It'll be this grind of these three songs every night. And in that 2 hours, we talked ourselves out of it.
Oh.
And so we went back to Dick's office and said, you know what? We're not going to do this. we want to take another route. And that was just, we were still young and we still wanted to record our original music, and we didn't want to give it up to the three songs a night, you know, 6-7 days a week, 2 shows a day, kind of bus with everybody. You know, look, in retrospect, I wish we would have done it, because we still could have done our thing that we wanted to do, doing that at the same time, and we would have made some money. Mm-hmm. But we didn't do that, but we went on to make some great albums that you've never heard, that nobody's ever heard, but they are truly terrific pieces of work, for sure.
Well, and I'll just point out, I think, you correct me if I'm wrong, at the end of the film, the family is reunited and does a song. Is it called Going Home?
Okay, yeah. At the very end, so it goes, Going Home is Barry's song. Okay. Bob talks about going home and what is going home and where is home. Mm-hmm. So we go into Going Home, and that's one of Barry's songs. And the last song going over credits, called Some Good Years, is it's in between Going Home, Rain the Park, and then over the last bit of credits in the film is Some Good Years. And that was on an album we did called Global. That's our most recent venture of an album, and that was done in the late 90s, I believe. But there's an album we did with a guy named Chuck Klogin, who at the time was doing Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen as their producer. So we would just sit there and wait for him to come. And when he'd come, and we did a whole album with him that never got released, an album called Cocaine Dream, a song written by John Hall. I know. You know, maybe that's why they never said, no, we can't have this album. Talking about cocaine.
You never know.
Yeah, you don't ever know.
But wait, I want to go back though to 1968 for a second. Christmas. You were telling me before we went on the air how Christmas worked in the Cowsills home.
Christmas could be a great time of year. Our mom tried to make Christmas just the very, very best time of the year. Even before there was a band, there was a lot of heartache, but she always made Christmas that special time. The only thing that would upset Christmas really would be that if one of the brothers would get in trouble around that time and that particular year, and I'm thinking 68, it could have been 67. My mind's a bit foggy right now, but Bill had given my dad a whole lot of heartache and trouble as teens. And my dad didn't take stuff like that very well. He was a pretty domineering kind of guy and kind of ruthless in manners. And Christmas was one of those times where you saw his true blood, and that was that he was mad at Bill, so he took all of Bill's Christmas presents, and we're talking at this point maybe a silver tone guitar, maybe a silver tone amp all gotten from Sears, and he put that under the tree and crossed Bill's name out and put Bob's name underneath. And so now Christmas morning, the happy parents who just, you know, been drunk all night, you know, now they're up with all these screaming kids all excited about this and that. And Bob's there, and you know, we're all feeling really weird. Bill is there sitting in a chair, all just, you know, looking PO'd, and there's Bob. You know, how is he going to gracefully, as a young kid? I thought it was more abuse on Bob to put his name on there,
right. Accepting
all these gifts, dude. I'm sure Bob was going, dude, don't give me his gifts. Go burn them or throw them away, but don't put this pressure on me. You know, but that's how Christmases could go at our house. They could be really great, or it could really be tense. There are a lot of tense times.
Well, and we learn later in the film, and back to the film, that there was a real separation between your dad, whose first name is Bud, I just want to mention in case we reference him that way, between Bud and Bill later. Bill is the oldest?
Yes, he was our oldest brother.
And you guys were performing, I think, in Las Vegas, and Bill and your dad are at a table gambling, and they're drinking, as Bill was old enough. And your dad got really pissed off at Bill for whatever he was doing. They were both drinking heavily, from what I understood. And Bill and your dad tells Bill he's out of the band, he's out of the family, and your brother gives him the finger and says, "Dad, fuck you."
Pretty close. But Bill gives Dad the finger,
right,
and says, "Fuck you," and then that was it, you know.
Oh.
But Bill had decided he was going to smoke some pot, you know, and him and Artie Kornfeld, who was the first producer, and that's the reason Artie lost his gig, was over smoking pot, you know, and not that he smoked it with any of us. It was just the 60s, man. It was you know, Strawberry Alarm Clock. It was you know, arty. You know, mm-hmm. You see him in Woodstock. He's losing his ass in the Woodstock movie, and he's getting interviewed, and he's going, "No, man, it's beautiful. Look at it, it's beautiful. It's all about love." And the guy goes, "Yeah, but you're not selling any tickets." He goes, "Oh man, that's okay. That's okay." And that's how Artie was. You know, it was that time. He was older than us, and so that was the beginning of the end for the Councils. So early in it, but you know, Bill and Dad just did not see eye to eye on anything. And Dad, you know, he was just trying to get himself into the music, and Dad thought he knew everything, and he really knew quite a bit. And we have to give him kudos for bringing this whole family to the top of a rung that very few get to. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, Bill wanted to be a Beatle or a Rolling Stone or something. He certainly didn't want to be singing Indian Lake with his mother.
I was just going to say, he's singing with his mother and his sister, and you know, probably okay that he's singing with his brothers. That was probably cool. But yeah, I mean, there's Susan, you know, in the short skirt singing and shaking her tambourine. And there's Mom in the background singing. And it's just
not quite what he was hoping for.
No, not a real hip and groovy kind of 60s thing.
But, you know, it's funny. And I know if you talk to John or Bob, you know, or Bill and Barry, which you can't anymore. But, you know, maybe someday you'll run into them. They'll tell you that it was, and not John and Barry so much, because they were so little. They couldn't have felt what a teenager was feeling about their mother and their sister being pushed into this band. And I walked in easy, because I demanded to get a role in this, and I was a boy. And, you know, people don't even know that I came in at the end or at the beginning, because we're always batched in. Well, there were the boys, and then there were the girls.
Mm-hmm. So. And tell me, was it Dick that your dad took out of the band?
Yeah, Richard and my dad, boy, they just never saw eye to eye. You know, I don't know if it was that they were so alike. You know, Bill was a lot like Dad. You know, these cats were real angry cats. You know, Bob, Susan, John, myself, we broke it up into green eyes and brown eyes. My dad had green eyes. Bill, Barry, and Richard all had green eyes, and they're all out of their freaking minds. Well, they were all out of their minds. And then you have John and Bob and myself and Susan, who have carried on as a Council band forever. Mm. And we all have brown eyes like Mom. So we always thought there was something to that.
Interesting. Yeah. Richard had just things did not go well for him. Did your dad actually send him off to the military and to Vietnam, or did he do that of his own?
No, what happened was, there was a big fight between me and Rich. We all had all moved to New York City, living in a small apartment at 888 8th Avenue. Hmm. And Richard was just not, you know, you had to play Dad's rules. You know, you're not going to be drinking. You're not going to be doing anything. And Richard could not stay with the rules. Hmm. And so he wasn't going to be in the band, because Dad knew this. This guy was going to be a nightmare. He wasn't going to toe the line as a good military family will. You know, Dad was in the Navy for 30 years. He expected everybody to be like ducks in a row. Hmm. No different personalities. Don't talk to anybody. Just stay in line. And that wasn't working for Richard. And so in New York, Dad and Richard, it came to a head, as it will with, you know, fathers and sons. And my dad said, "You are out of here. You are joining the circus. Look at, I got drafted when I was 19. And you did you did not dodge the draft. You did not go to Canada. You were not a conscientious objector. You know, you were going in," and we all understood that. It was never even a thought in our mind. When I got drafted, all I knew was that I needed to get in the Navy. So I just went and joined the Navy and ripped that letter up. And so Richard was told to go join the service. And Bob, you got to remember back then, too, even when I was in the service, you were in the service with guys that joined up and then guys that, like, were put in front of a judge. And the judge said, "Hey, you know, I got two things for you. You can either go to jail or you can go into the service." And those were two things that were happening way back then. So my father saying that to Richard, "Here's your two things. You're going in the service and you're going in the service." Because that's, my dad probably felt that Richard needed to grow up and to learn some discipline. I don't know. But he did force that issue. And then Richard, being the time that he went, it was Vietnam. You know, it was in the Army. So off he went to Vietnam.
And it was hard on him, I know. And, you know, kids, I hate to say kids today, it makes me sound very old saying it, but the last two generations of, you know, young men who haven't had to deal with a draft, don't really understand, don't know what it was like then. In that, I mean, I remember, I mean, I was young, you know, in 70, I was 10 years old, but I remember you knew that there were people in the neighborhood. There were young guys who were in Vietnam. There were young guys who were in Canada because they were dodging the draft. And, you know, you'd hear about these guys and you're just like, what? And, you know, you just couldn't believe. There's no connection to today because, you know, we have an all-volunteer army and people don't know what it's like to have your life ripped apart by being told you will go and serve and you will go to the jungles of Vietnam.
It's the craziest thing, you know, and that is the difference. And you know, I believe, yeah, all our soldiers are heroes, you know. But sometimes for me, it gets a little overwhelming when I'm sitting in an airport, you know, and a young soldier comes off, you know, just off the plane through the gate, and everybody is standing and cheering and giving standing ovations. And when we all were in the service back during Vietnam, everybody hated us.
Yeah.
The public, John Q. Public hated us. I mean, you know, my brother Richard got spit on after spending all this time in Vietnam, you know, trying to keep everybody's butt safe over here. We weren't heroes. We were, you know, looked upon, you know, in the worst way. And so it's funny how a couple of generations goes by and now everybody's a hero, you know, and it's a weird thing for us back then.
It's, again, such a different time. I know. I can't imagine that there was ever a period that people didn't appreciate these young men who went and, you know, served their country. It skipped that whole generation, because the World War I guys, the World War II, the Korea guys, they all got respect. They were seen, but Vietnam was the undeclared war. It was such a mess, and you guys just never got respect for it.
No, you're right. It was just, it's almost like going back to your old record player. All of a sudden, a scratch comes into our record.
Yeah.
And it's like, and now you go from the first chorus all the way to the third verse, you know, and that's what you got left on your vinyl. It's kind of like what happened, you know, because, yeah, first, second World War, Korean War, hero, 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 Vietnam guys went there like we wanted to go.
Right. Oh, yeah. No.
Did anybody really want to go? Nobody I knew wanted to be in the service. Nobody I knew.
Now, there's a story, and I thought it was Richard, but maybe I'm wrong. But there's a story in the film where one of the brothers comes back from Vietnam and tells, and the story is told, went to your father and said, "Where's the trust fund money? Where's the trust fund?" And your dad said, "What money?"
Well, you know, it's funny because my wife turns to me because we didn't have Showtime. So I had to get Showtime. I wasn't going to get Showtime, Bob. I thought, well, I don't need to see this freaking movie again because we've seen it a couple of times, but I've never seen it in that state. And then I looked to Luann and I said, you know, I think as years go by here, I'm going to regret not having gotten Showtime so I can see the guide where it says Family Band, the Council Story on the guide. And then just to the new ending of the movie and just the way the numbers are all off the Ed Sullivan and Johnny Carson shows, those funny numbers that they have on Keenies and things like that. So
I was asking you about the trust fund.
So we're watching the movie the other night and Luann says, "Oh wow, so that happened to everybody." And what Richard's talking about is the trust funds were all set up in the Chemical Bank of New York City in New York City. Okay. That's where it was. And over the years, this money went in and money went in and money went in and, you know, money came out. You know, Dad bought a bunch of land and there were, you know, you hear Richard talking about the Jackie Coogan Law, which protects minors from having their money stolen. But, you know, there are so many loopholes in that law that, you know, that law would never stand up in any court because, you know, my dad, I remember saying, "Hey, you guys want to buy some land?" And, you know, "Oh yeah, sure, Dad." You know, off he went, bought a bunch of land that he lost, you know, in a bad deal, but took money. So we all had to meet Dad outside the Chemical Bank in New York City when he turned 21. Because that's where you went to get your bank book, your passbook that said it is empty, but you could go back and you could see all the money that was in people's accounts, you know, and there were millions of dollars that were never received by the kids. You know, and even though Richard wasn't in the band, you know, even when I wasn't in the band, we were always, the family was the band. I mean, me and Richard were like road guys. We would do the gear and all that. But at the very, 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 very early beginning, 65, 66, me and Rich were as famous as everybody because me and Rich would stand by the gear while the guys performed, and we'd stand in front, you know, and we were the hard asses, and, you know, nobody messes with our brothers and that kind of thing, you know. So, so as far as the money, yeah, there was no money. There has never been any money. The money's never happened. But when I was 16, I had a brand new Challenger 440 RT. Bob had a brand new GTO. We were living. I felt it. There was just really no money, you know, so to speak.
It's beyond comprehension that you guys did all that you did, the fame, the sense that, you know, you had to have gotten rich from that, and that you didn't. There's no money. And even to this day, I guess what I came away wondering is, to this day, was there been any resolution on that? I mean, if someone downloads a Cowsills album after seeing you today, do you guys get any piece of that at all?
Not right now, but we have a lawyer, Stephen Brown, came to us and goes, guys, we're getting burned here because we didn't own any of our music. We were doing a show one time and we put a little, for like when the people come, you know, the meet and greets. Mm-hmm. So we put a little CD together, and then we had the Cowsill website. And so when you used to go to the Cowsill website, you would hear We Can Fly or Indian Lake or Rain the Park. Well, Universal, who owns all the music, okay, they bought it from MGM, who bought it from Lenny Stogel. We have never received anything from 1968 as far as royalties from any of this music. You know, and although our music wasn't the A sides, there was always a written Cowsill song on the B sides of these million sellers. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we are now in the process of suing Universal for Universal Music Group for all of our back stuff, it'll all end this year. We're going to find out. You know, they've already said, yeah, we're going to give you your songs back, but then they wanted to just give us $5,000 for all of the back royalty.
Jesus.
So, you know, and in the last, I think they got a boy. Everybody out there, these numbers, they could be all out of whack coming out of my brain. But from what I understood, they've sold quite a bit of Cowsill music in the last 3 years. And they're talking about going back just 3 years instead of going back to, you know, the heyday and then all of that. So right. So that's all going to wash out this year, though, Bob.
I've been hearing a lot this year about copyrights starting to wind down on music recorded in certain periods of time, as the copyright law changes, people like Tom Petty getting back his entire catalog, and Prince already got his. That was kind of a different deal. But other artists getting back their catalog. Are you guys affected by that at all, by the change in copyright law?
I don't think we're going to be affected by that. What I think we're going to be affected by is that the judge is going to see the insanity of what these guys did to a mother and her children coming along, and, you know, and they're going to give us the music back. They've already said they can have their music back. Where the negotiation is right now is, well, what are we going to pay these guys? You know, what are we going to give them? There's a few laws out there that says, you know, they have to pay us a certain percentage. For all these years, they paid nothing, but that's all going to come out in the wash.
Is a lot of the issue not necessarily what these companies did to the Cowsills family, but what your dad did to the Cowsills family?
What our dad did to the Cowsills family. These Madison Avenue, everybody were there. You know, they're doing their job. They're trying to, you know, everybody's trying to get the most that they can for the least, you know, output. And so they just threw numbers up in front of my old man, and he would sell stuff. He would sell stuff. But the problem was that my dad had minors, and Bob and Bill, we got these contracts that our lawyer had sent to us, and we all signed these contracts. Well, Bob and Bill signed contracts stating that they weren't minors, that they were over 21 years old. And there's Bob, who's barely 18, signing his name. So, you know, so Stephen, our lawyer, goes, oh, my God, and we found this. We found this in the how every lawyer's find stuff, and he brought that to the court and said, are you guys kidding me? And so that's where we're at. Wow. So not to say that Madison Avenue and the big hungry business dogs didn't have something to do with, you know, pulling the wool over a guy's eye who had not better than a fifth grade education, was in the service for 30 years and hardly became chief in 30 years because he kept getting his, you know, broken down because he couldn't watch his drink. So he kept screwing up his whole life. You know, they saw him coming with all these children, ducks in a row, coming down Madison Avenue, and they were scooped up. Well, and my dad was just, you know, he was a drunk, and he made ill decisions, bad decisions on things. You know, when we did our first Ed Sullivan show, okay, well, it was a live show, right, Bob?
Yeah.
Well, there was no, so right when the guy started singing the Rain, the Park, and other things, the mics were dead. Now, we had 10 Ed Sullivan shows all lined out to do, a big contract, the biggest contract ever with the, you know, that a band would make this much off of TV shows and stuff like that. And Ed wanted all the rights to everything and all this other stuff. And
the contract with Sullivan.
Oh, and so then it starts up, and all of a sudden, because I'm in the audience, I'm not even in the band yet. Susan up on there, me and Dick and Dad are sitting in the audience, nothing. My old man jumps up out of that seat and goes into the booth where they're just trying to put their show on. And he's drunk, and I just think that he came unglued and was very unprofessional and drunk. And then there were just two Ed Sullivan shows to do instead. And that was the first one. They let us do the second one, and then we never saw him again. And so, yeah, Dad had a lot to do with a lot of making a lot of people tense about even touching us because he was a goonball.
Well, I think there's something in the movie about how he didn't create any lasting relationships with businesses, that he would make these great deals and then they would fall apart because he would ruin them. He would just it's hard. I mean, he's not here to defend himself, but so much of this is indefensible. It's just, and there's the stuff about your dad. I mean, I want people to discover some of it in the film, but there's so much bad about the dad. Now, did your parents stay married their entire lives?
They did.
My God.
We are Irish Catholic, okay? And Mom and Dad had no sense of rhythm. I think they had way too many kids, and they just didn't know how to stop this stuff from happening. I really think it was ignorance on a lot of levels.
Yeah.
You know, and it's funny because we got to think about what their upbringing was, okay? And sure, their life was tough. They're out of that whole generation of people, you know, on the welfare thing, the whole thing's happening. And what my mom and dad didn't do, and I think it is what we all did, was that we decided that this all had to change. Yeah. Okay. So it was shit from our parents. So my dad, yeah. Okay. It was shitty when he was a kid. And so all he knew was to make it shitty for these kids. Because that's how it always went with these numbers, you know, the shrinks, they'll tell you, man, if you're hit, you're going to hit. If you're abused, you're going to be an abuser. And I remember, you know, at 19, I had my first kid, you know, and that's kind of young, but I had done so much by then. And I go in and I tell my dad, you know, he goes, oh yeah, well, you know, what's next after marriage, don't you? And I go, what, Dad? He goes, kids. He goes, then what? You know? And I go, well, then I'm going to show you how it can be done. And I made a real point. I put blinders on. And I just kept my nose straight to the grindstone with these children and was going to stop this madness right here and not carry it on. And now it's stopped. My children I have grandchildren now, and it's all about love, love, love. You know? And so I don't know how life is, but it's a crazy deal.
Well, there's one more thing about your dad, and then I'll let this go. And you can probably guess where I'm going to go with this. There was an incident that your sister talks about, Susan, when she was 10, 11, where your dad – and it's not entirely clear if this was a one-time thing or an ongoing thing, but your dad did attempt to be physically abusive, and I don't mean slapping her. And people can use their imagination here. And she got through that. She defeated him at that. It didn't happen. But shortly after that, she was sent to live with you.
Yes.
Right? So yes. What I wondered is, did you know what had happened, or did you find that out much later?
I've talked to Susan about this, you know, and we found out later. I mean, I found out, you know, probably right up against when Susan was 11 and when all that stuff was coming down for her. I had no idea look at, I mean, I would go into my parents' room, and Susan always slept with my parents on the road. Okay. That was her room. She didn't have her own room. She was never able to come hang with us. Mm-hmm. But I would go into that room every now and then, my mother's room, and boy, there would be suitcases flying across the room between my mother and father. And they were just angry, drinking Irish, crazy people, you know, and, you know, it was just, no. So I never knew that that was happening. Shit, I was watching for my own shrapnel, right, man. They were just coming. I mean, I was keeping down and trying to stay low and keep out of that cat's way. Because, boy, when you were in his sights, your life was excruciatingly painful, you know. So I was, but then when Susan came to live with me, that, you know, it all came out, you know, all this bullshit.
Well, we hear in the movie too that just piling it on, that your mother's sisters, your aunts, your dad tried to have sex with them,
and he tried to have sex with my aunt's kids.
Oh,
so it would be my cousin. So yeah, he was just totally. I think he had some real issues. I mean, gosh, we could get deep. See, for everybody out there, this the family band, the Council story, is a documentary. You know, it isn't the movie. It's just telling a story. And there were so many rabbit holes. God bless Louise and Bill and the producers of this movie that they didn't get down one of those rabbit holes. They would have never gotten out. You can go down Dad's rabbit hole and you can spend 5 hours of a film just on the old man. Mm. You know, you can go down Mom's rabbit hole. You can go down any one of the kids' rabbit holes and you'd never get out. You know, when I was worried about this movie coming out, Luann goes, "What are you worried about, Paul?" I go, "Well, I'm just worried about how I'm going to appear." And she looked at me and she goes, "Paul, the movie's not about you. So don't worry about it. This is a big family. That, you know, don't think you're like the main dude." And I go, "Well, I don't think that." She goes, "Remember that. It's a big family. There's not enough time to go down every rabbit hole, come out and keep going, you know." So,
well, and Paul, let me ask you about your mom, because the thing I came away from the film, the documentary, we should make clear, it is a documentary. This is not made up stories, which is what makes it all the more just amazing. Right. I kind of came away from it feeling like the filmmakers went easy on your mom. That she had to bear some responsibility for what happened to you guys. And I know it was a different time, and I know there are a lot of women who were oppressed by their husbands and who were put in their place, but so many things she had been aware of. But while your dad comes off as a pretty bad villain in the film, your mom doesn't really – it seems like we kind of sugarcoat a lot of stuff with her, good and bad. She just doesn't have a high profile. She sang with the band, and she was always visible, but we don't really have a sense of her in the film, I thought.
I think you're right about that. You know, you talk to Bob and John and talk to over half of my family, and they're going to put Mom into the category of being one of the kids. Okay, well, she was just one of the kids. You can't fault her. She was just one of the kids. Now, you put Susan and me. Now, Susan's biggest deal is she doesn't let Mom off the hook, nor do I, because I've been a parent. I don't care if you're having these children, then you have to stand up and get these children out of harm's way. And she never did that. And I'm going to see her someday, and I'm going to smack her right up back of her head going, "What the hell were you thinking, keeping us all there?" Susan's issue with Mom is, back to that little scene in the movie, Mom goes, and this is what pisses Susan off. Mom says, "Well, Susan, where do you want to go? What do you want to do, Susan?" Mom didn't go, "Susan, pack your bag and I'm getting you the fuck out of here." You know, that wasn't said.
Right.
And so that right there, when Susan realizes, okay, she is not with me. She is with him.
Right.
"Oh, where do I want to go? Send me to Paul." Because I took care of Susan. I was right in the middle. I had the three over me and the three under me. Mm. So John and Barry and Susan, I took care of them. I changed their diapers. I mean, I raised the kid. So it was only natural that she would come live with me, you know. But to let Mom off the hook, no, I didn't like it. They didn't use any of the footage when they talked to me about it, because I said no. I call bullshit on her being one of the six kids. I mean, I get it. I get it. My old man was rough and tumble, and he was ugly, and he was drunk, and he was mean. And I could see maybe being so weak, you just go, oh, I cannot screw with this cat, man, because I'm going to look like them. But she would just stand. She'd sit there over in the corner with a bathrobe on while we were getting hammered. I mean, these were hour-long sessions. Mm. This was not like a little clip on the head going, now, come on, boys. You can do better than this. These were hour-long, hours and hours of beating, suns coming up, Saturday morning, not being able to open the door to our friends because you can't recognize our faces because it looks like we all have either chicken pox or poison oak or something, you know, and it was just from the beatings. And she'd just sit there smoking a cigarette, looking pissed as all hell. Now, in her brain, she might have been pissed at herself and all of this, you know, we can get psychoanalytical on this. You could spend hours here, days even, to get pillows and be eating here talking about that, you know, but no. I did think she got off easy. And when I'm at these Q&As on these film festivals, or anybody time anybody talks to me, and even when Bob, when he's asked the question, well, what about your mom? He says, oh, she was the one that brought Christmas time and music into my life. She was what brought everything beautiful into my life, you know? But Bob will even say, but you should ask Paul or Susan how they feel about this, because this is just my opinion and how I decide to deal with mom. You know, I was pissed at that gal. I'll tell you what, Bob, I'll tell you, from 1966 to 1970, every Mother's Day, I would just go by her and I'd go, oh, Mom, it's in the mail. It's in the mail. I was bitter. I was the little guy.
God.
I was mad and really fearful. I was always very afraid. And Bob was my, when I was afraid, I would get with Bob because he would somehow talk me down of being just totally freaked out, you know, and Mom was not that person. And so to Bob and Bill and Dick and Barry and John and all them, Mom was running for her life as well, all with the rest of us. Well, I don't buy it, dude. Then don't have them. Then don't have the kid.
Right.
You know.
Well, let's it's tempting to keep going because there's so much in the movie, but I want people to see the film because we've barely scratched the surface here. So let's do this as we wrap up. We know what you're doing now. You're Grimm, and you worked on the Twilight film, the Timothy Hutton series Leverage, which I think was TNT, and of course we should mention that Grimm is on NBC on Friday nights.
Friday nights. Watch it, guys. Everybody watch Grimm.
And go and check MrMedia.com. You can find some audio interviews with a whole lot of the cast. What is current for the Cowsills now? And I know Susan has her own band. Can you just tell folks?
Well, we can get rid of John real quick. He's the Beach Boy drummer. So he isn't drumming with us.
Wow, that's cool.
Because they do 280 shows a year, and we don't, you know? And so that's what Johnny's doing. And John is the best drummer in the whole frickin' world, I'm going to tell you. And he sings Beach Boy songs better than Beach Boys ever wish they could sing them. And Susan has her own band. It's the Susan Cowsill Band. Mm-hmm. And Bob has his own band, the Bob Cowsill Band. And my band is the Cowsills. Because I've never had another band. I've never, you know, I was never the musical genius guy. You know, I mean, it took a lot of work for me just to be able to play a piano and sing at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, and now, you know, and for my brother Bob and my brothers and my sister, that's second nature to them. You know, and so I always had to work hard. So I only play with the Cowsills because it's what I do. This is what makes me happy with music, you know. And I love working. I love being out in the forest. And that's why I do my jobs. But Bob has his own band. But Bob's also a computer guy. And he works for a doctor. And they do conventions. And they have this program that is interesting. And it might be one of many. But the one I know about that I laughed at was a program that they give to hospitals now to make sure that nurses are charging the right for everybody's Q-tips and little plastic cup, and, you know, making sure none of that gets by. And so he goes all around the country doing conventions and teaching doctors about this program, how to use it at their hospital.
Very good.
And that's what he's doing. And Susan, but his band, man, he has a great band, you know. He does, God, for 25 years, he's been singing in a pub with just him and the guitar. The beginning of the movie. Mm-hmm. Did you see the beginning of the movie?
Yeah.
Well, where he's walking in with his microphone and that's called the pub. It's on Ventura Avenue, in California, Southern California, on Ventura Avenue, and he's been there 25 years.
Wow!
And so, what he does, so he'll do. Gosh, he could do 60 songs in one night.
Wow!
You know, him and his guitar. And you know, Bill had taken that road, and Barry had taken that road as well. You know, and Bob's done it, and Susan does it in New Orleans. You know, Susan lives in New Orleans.
All right. Well, folks, listen, you can check your local listings for the next showing of the documentary, Family Band, The Cowsill Story. It's on Showtime this month, and I'm sure it'll continue and be available in other ways as well. And you can also order albums by The Cowsills right now at a great price at MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. Keep in mind, the money is not yet going to these guys. So if you want to wait a few months,
might be a good idea.
Yeah, we don't want to, you know, we don't need to enrich, you know, the corporate coffers until we know that these guys are going to finally start collecting some of that money.
Interject, June 22nd at the Cannery East in Las Vegas, we're going to be doing a show with Paul Revere and the Raiders.
Oh, boy.
And we've seen Paul, we've been trying to hook up to play together for a long time. It just hasn't kind of worked out. But we're doing this show, and then in January, we're going on a Paul Revere and the Raiders cruise. And so we'll be out there with some other bands that they take along, the Drifters and Mary Wilson and the Cowsills and Paul Revere.
So maybe there's still hope for a reunion of the 1910 Fruit Gum Company.
Yummy, yummy, yummy.
Yummy, 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 yummy. I got love in my tummy.
Joey Levine.
Oh, God. Is there a website for the Cowsills?
Yeah, cowsill.com.
Very good. All right.
We'll get you there, and our shows are there. There's calendars of shows, who's playing where, and we're real active. And
tell me about the Rhode Island Hall of Fame.
So, Bob, on April 28th, we are being inducted into the Rhode Island Hall of Fame. It's not the big one, but we're okay with the Rhode Island Hall of Fame. And so I went online to find out, well, Rhode Island Music Hall of Fame, who would be going into that? And this is the first year of inductions. And Buzz and George M. Cohan.
Wow.
I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy. That guy is being inducted with us.
Wow.
We're performing at it. He is not.
That makes sense. Will you be doing Yankee Doodle Dandy?
Maybe we'll do Yankee Doodle Dandy for him.
Okay, that seems good.
That's a big night for us, you know. Rhode Island has been great to us. They've even got Helen Brooks Day, my grandmother, who lived to be 104, and they gave her a special day, and this is a really special thing, having them ask us to be in this Hall of Fame. We're humbled by it, for sure.
That's awesome. That's very awesome. Well, Paul Cowsill, great conversation. I feel like I finally kind of bookended that 1968 Christmas gift I got.
That's crazy.
It's a terrific film. It will get you emotional. There's no doubt, but it is a terrific film. It tells a great story. Not always happy at times, but
right.
Well worth it. Whether you knew the Cowsills then, or if you have an interest in music, or you just want to see a good story. Paul, continued good luck on Grimm. We'll be hoping for a third season renewal for you. And for
we're all hoping for it. So everybody's got to start banging in Grimm 3. We got to have it. Can we do this again sometime?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Boy,
well,
I love it.
Here's what we should do. We should get you set up on set, and we should do it from the set of Grimm. And get a couple folks, you know, to just kind of pop in and out while we're talking.
That's funny.
And we'll talk. I'll send you the notes on who's actually already been on the show. It'll be easier that way. Try that.
Okay.
All right. Paul, great to have you here. Continued good luck, and tell the rest of the family hello for us, and thanks for being on Mr. Media today.
Thank you, Bob, and I will say hi.
Okay. You can see and hear almost 1,000 Mr. Media interviews by visiting our main site, MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com, or check out the more than 200 video interviews on the Mr. Media radio site on YouTube. And I'd sure appreciate if you'd show some love for Mr. Media's advertisers, including Stitcher. Apple named Stitcher a top 5 news app of 2011. It's a free mobile app for your smartphone or tablet that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. You can listen whenever you want to more than 5,000 shows, get customized recommendations, and discover what your friends are listening to. My own list of Stitcher favorites is pretty eclectic. I start my day with an hour of MSNBC's Morning Joe with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. Then it's the latest two-minute update from the Onion News Network. After that, I'll listen to WTF with Mark Maron, Here's the Thing with Alec Baldwin, HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, and excerpts from E's Chelsea Lately and The Soup with Joel McHale. Also in regular rotation on my Stitcher playlist, The BS Report with ESPN's Bill Simmons, The TechCrunch Headlines, and The Don Geronimo Show. The latest episodes of each show, whether originating from broadcasts, cable TV, radio syndication, or podcasts, are continuously updated. Stitcher is a free app for your iPhone, iPad, Kindle, Fire, BlackBerry, Droid, and more. And show your support of Mr. Media by getting, did I mention it's free? The app at stitcher.com/Mr. Media. That's stitcher.com/MR Media. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We're also supported by Audible. Check out Audible's 30-day trial membership and download the audiobook version of the book everyone's been talking about, 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. Sign up for your free trial today at audible.com/radio. Again, audibletrial.com/radio. And finally, if you need a disc jockey for a wedding, bar mitzvah, corporate event, or just a big old party, please consider calling 1-800-DIAL-DJS, the party authority, for all your party entertainment needs. You can call 1-800-DIAL-DJS or go to their website, 1-800-DIAL-DJS.com, and tell them Mr. Media sent you. And thanks for listening. Today's episode of Mr. Media Interviews is brought to you by GoDaddy.com. You know GoDaddy.com from their wild and sexy commercials, but isn't it time you actually test drove their web hosting and domain registration services yourself? For a limited time, Mr. Media listeners can save 10% on the already low price of web hosting services at GoDaddy.com by entering the promo code POD4 at checkout. Again, that's 10% off web hosting when you go to GoDaddy.com and enter the promo code POD4, that's P-O-D, the number 4, at checkout.